Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are getting into a set of sources that I think demand a really radical shift in how you see the world.
A huge shift.
We're not looking at masterpieces in museums or, you know, sculptures carved from marble. We're diving into a body of work that moves art out of the gallery and, well, directly onto and into you. The central question we're tackling today is, wer ist Kunst? Who is art?
And that phrase, who is art, is really the key. It unlocks this whole lineage of conceptual art running from, what, the 1910s right up to today?
So what's our path here?
We're charting a course through some really influential claims. We'll start with Joseph Baillet's big one, every human is art.
Right.
Then we'll filter that through the shocking performance art of Tim Ulrichs, who literally tried to make himself the first living artwork. And then we'll see how contemporary groups like the Joblin Factory are running with it today.
With their whole flesh is art thing.
Exactly. It gets pretty provocative.
So our mission really is to unpack how the individual human being became either literally or philosophically a work of art. And maybe more importantly, what the social and political implications of that actually are.
Well, if you accept the premise, it just collapses the whole hierarchy between the person looking and the person creating.
It changes everything.
It completely changes how we judge creativity and maybe even human value itself.
Okay, let's get into it. Before we can even talk about the human as art, we have to take a step back.
To the crucial first step.
Yeah, the scaffolding had to be built first. And that started not with a person, but with a thing, an everyday object, the ready-made.
Kicked off by Marcel Duchamp around 1915.
And Duchamp's whole intervention was so important because it shifted the definition of art away from, you know, the skill of the hand.
Right, and toward the power of the mind, the idea. The ready-made proved that just a found object, something totally ordinary, could be art.
Just because he said so.
Simply because the artist selected it and declared it so. Our sources call it undressing the object of its normal function.
I love that phrase.
You take it out of its context, put it on a pedestal, and suddenly its meaning is gone. It's just a shape, an idea.
It's like conceptual judo. Mm-hmm. You're using the object's own functional energy and just flipping it into an aesthetic question.
And he didn't just do it once. He was systematic about it. He explored all the different ways you could do this.
What were the main categories?
Well, first you had the assisted ready-made. That's where he'd combine one object with another, like the famous bicycle wheel on a kitchen stool from 1913. He didn't make either part.
But the combination was his statement. He became more of a curator or an assembler.
Precisely. Then you had the rectified ready-made. He'd take a cheap reproduction of something famous, like the Mona Lisa.
Oh, the one with the mustache.
Exactly. And he'd just slightly alter it. It's an intervention into culture itself. And then finally, there was the printed ready-made, which was often just based on language, puns, poetry, making the idea even more important than the thing.
So if a common mass-produced bottle rack or a urinal can become art just by declaration and placement, that leads to the big pivot point.
Hmm.
What happens when you apply that same power, that same declaration, not to a thing, but to a person?
And that jump, that is what separates Duchamp from the next generation. It shifts the whole focus from the material world to the biological and the social subject.
Which happened in a big way in Germany around 1961. This is where the conceptual freedom gets really wild.
This is where Tim Ulrichs comes in.
He just took that logical step and declared himself the first living artwork. He decided he didn't need a pedestal.
He was the pedestal. And this wasn't just a gimmick for him. It was a total lifelong commitment.
He called himself a total artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
He even set up an advertising center for total art.
He did. And his self-declaration led to an actual public event, a self-exhibition, a Selbsthausstellung in 1965. He physically put himself on display as the work.
It's one thing to declare an object as art, but when you declare yourself art, it means the art has to live and eat and sleep.
And eventually die. It completely merges your job with your existence.
And he wasn't totally alone in this idea of the living sculpture, was he?
No, you see others exploring similar ground around the same time. The principle was in the air that the human body could be the medium.
Like Piero Manzoni's piece, The Base Magica, from the same year, 1961.
A simple pedestal.
Yeah, and visitors could just step onto it. And for as long as they stood there, Manzoni said they were a living sculpture. It was temporary. Consensual.
Or think about Gilbert and George's The Singing Sculpture in 1969. They weren't acting. They just coated themselves in metallic paint, stood still, and sang underneath the arches. over and over.
They weren't representing something. They were the thing. They were the medium.
Exactly. But what makes Ulrich stand out is how far he pushed the idea of inseparability.
The idea that the art can't be removed from the artist.
Right. And he did that most powerfully with his own skin, with tattoos or tätowierungen.
He saw skin as a canvas.
Literally, a shaped canvas stretched over the skeleton. For him, art and literature weren't just near the body, they were written or onto the body. They became flesh.
So the art is branded on him. The artist and artwork are one. But that raises a kind of logistical question, doesn't it? How do you sell that?
You can't, and that's the point. It creates this fascinating problem for the art market. The value shifts from a collectible object to a conceptual presence to his biography. The art is his life.
And he took that to the absolute extreme.
The ultimate gesture.
In 1981, he tattooed the words "the end" on his eyelid. It's so theatrical, so permanent, and a little morbid.
He said he saw his eyelids closing as like the final curtains on the eye cinema of his life. It's this piece of permanent theater written right onto his body.
Linking art directly to mortality.
To the human condition.
So Ulrich made himself the literal masterpiece, but can we all be masterpieces? That feels like the point where Joseph Beuys comes in and scales this up from one person to a whole society.
Beuys is the one who created the philosophical engine to make Ulrich's literal act a universal idea. He said it plainly in 1983. I myself am the artwork. It should lead to the point where the human himself becomes the artwork.
It's an egalitarian statement. If I can be art, so can you.
And this whole universal claim is built on his framework, the Erweiter's Kunstbegriff.
The expanded concept of art. So why did he feel art needed to be expanded?
Well, for Beuys, traditional materials, canvas, paint, clay, were just too limiting. They kept creativity locked up with a small group of professionals. He argued that the creative spark is in everyone.
And it shows up in ways other than painting.
Yes, in really fundamental human actions, in thought, in speech, in discussion. By expanding the definition of art to include all of that, he makes it so every single person has the capacity to be a creator, a Künstler.
So the art isn't the thing you make. The art is the process of shaping the world with your ideas and your words.
Precisely. And that leads right into his core political idea, social plastic, socialplastic.
Social plastic.
Beuys believed that when people collaborate, when they cooperate to shape their society and their politics, that is the ultimate artwork. The discussions, the decisions, the votes, that's the material, that's the sculpture.
Wow. So a well-run community meeting or even the act of voting becomes a profoundly creative act. You're sculpting the world.
It gives civic duty an aesthetic weight. But he also knew the individual spark had to come first. He talked about private plastic.
Private versus social.
Your private plastic is your own thoughts, your ideas, your words. They're raw, maybe a bit egoistical, but they're necessary. They're the raw material that then has to be shaped and directed into the collective goal, the social plastic.
That makes sense. Your individual moment of inspiration is the fuel, but it has to contribute to the bigger project of society.
And this whole philosophy just makes traditional art supplies seem almost pointless.
There's that great quote that sums it up. He said, "The mistake starts when someone prepares to buy stretchers and canvas."
Yes. He's saying if your creativity depends on buying stuff, you've already missed the point. The real art is inside you, your capacity for thought and for social action.
That's a radical democratization of art, but it also politicizes it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If the creative process is thought and speech, then deciding what art is becomes a democratic process. Our sources call it discursive Kunst.
Discursive art.
Yeah, an ongoing conversation like a political election where everyone gets a say in what counts as art.
And the most profound implication of all this, of seeing every human as art, is the idea of art rights. Why have basic rights Grundrechte when you could have Kunstrechte?
This is the absolute peak of the philosophy. These sources lay out these radical proposals for protecting the human not just as a moral subject, but as an aesthetic one.
Giving every person inherent value as a unique living creation.
That's powerful stuff.
The first proposed right is, the dignity of the human as art is inviolable. The second, every person has the freedom to be art, to develop, live, and die as art.
And the third ensures equality. All people are art, no matter their gender, race, religion. It's a non-negotiable state of being. And you also get freedom of conscience. You don't have to see yourself as art.
Right. And freedom of opinion to see others as art.
Yeah.
It just shifts the whole conversation away from skill or talent. It's not about, did you paint that well? It's about upholding the right of self-determination as an art form.
It's an aesthetic argument for democratic values. But of course, the concept keeps expanding, sometimes into, let's say, uncomfortable and very commercial places.
Which brings us right up to the present day, to the contemporary extreme. The German group Joblin Factory, who connect Beuys' idea directly to a much more visceral statement.
Fleisch ist Art. Fleisch ist Kunst.
That's a provocative move. Yeah. It brings the conversation right back to raw materiality. Beuys took art into the realm of thought.
Social plastic. And Joblin Factory just collapses it right back onto the body, onto the meat. They're juxtaposing this idea of a thinking, living artwork with the simple fact of decay.
They're putting mortality and the biological reality of the body front and center. The flesh itself is the aesthetic object.
And they don't just leave that as an idea. They sell it. They apply it to the market through multiples. You can buy signed, democratized versions of their concepts.
Right, like their meat bags or the bulimia flesh clock.
Or the flesh phone. They're making the idea of the body as art, something you can consume, something visible. They force you to participate in the commercialization of the flesh.
So is this Fleischkunst, flesh art, is it a continuation of Beuys' idea or a simplification of it?
That's the question they pose, isn't it? It shifts the focus from subject kunst, subject art, where the art is the thinking self, to something focused purely on the raw, perishable material of the body itself.
The ultimate challenge. If we're all living artworks, then every part of our biological reality, even the uncomfortable parts, the parts tied to mortality, has to be part of that aesthetic discussion.
You're forced to confront the medium.
What a journey. I mean, we've gone from Duchamp putting a urinal on a pedestal, all the way to Tim Ulrichs tattooing the end on his eyelid, and then Dewey's saying political action is a social sculpture.
The human subject isn't just a performer anymore.
No. The human subject is the medium, permanently.
And if we really accept that, then analyzing a human as a work of art, the Stanilis, becomes this mammoth task, as the source puts it.
How can you even begin?
Exactly. Analyzing a painting is one thing, but analyzing a person as art, you'd have to consider their entire biography, their thoughts, their actions, their genetics, their mortality.
It's an artwork that's constantly changing.
Constantly evolving. It demands totally new ways of thinking, far beyond traditional art criticism.
Which means your life right now is basically this incredibly complex public performance that can't be fully assessed until it's over. And maybe not even then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tim Ulrichs once said something interesting. He said, art is the memory of a better future. If every human is art and we're all contributing to this giant social plastic, where does forgetting fit in?
That's the final twist, isn't it? If your life is art, what part of that messy, contradictory piece deserves to be remembered?
Well, Ulrichs actually prepared his own gravestone. And the inscription is this final paradoxical instruction. It says, always remember to forget me.
Wow.
So if your life is art, what is the value of your memory? And what would you want the world to forget? Something to think about as you move through your day, realizing that you are the ultimate ever-changing artwork.